Welcome everybody out there to Attentive While Oblivious podcast. We have Nate on the mic, and his son is here too. He's just hanging out back there behind the monitors. This episode number 33, we got a special subject today. So Nate is recovered
drug addict.
Yep. He has a couple of programs. He's going to go into his story and tell what he does, and then we're going to talk about that caring, non-caring, how to keep the straight and narrow from there. So take it away, Nate.
Yeah, so my story, you want me to just go?
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah.
My story starts when I was younger. I had good parents, grew up in a, I guess you would call it, a pretty functional and average household. Great mom, great dad. Had something that happened to me when I was younger. My babysitter had attempted to molest me, and it didn't go as far as it could have, but it went far enough to leave its mark, you know.
So that was a trigger.
Yeah. Yep. So she told me to keep it a secret, and she put her finger in my face. She said, "Don't tell anybody about this." And so from that point on, that kind of just carrying that baggage and carrying that in the back of your mind and your subconscious just weighed me down more than I thought it did. Mm-hmm. And I just had blocked it out for myself. I didn't know what happened. I was protecting myself from it, I guess, and doing what she told me to keep it a secret. So even from myself, but, years go by, still pretty normal and average, you know. I'm probably doing a little bit of attention seeking in school and acting out a little bit and class clowning and
so normal stuff.
Yeah. It was pretty normal stuff. Just a boy being a knucklehead, you know? And then I start to get into, I find weed when I'm 14 years old. And I smoke it once, and I just get hooked on it, man. I start smoking every day freshman year, ditching school, and grades start to fall. Still doing football, still doing some sports. That's kind of keeping me out of trouble. And I'm still doing okay, I guess, but, mm-hmm. you know, definitely flirting with bad decisions, making bad decisions. Sophomore year comes. I tried mushrooms for the first time. I start drinking a little more. I get in a little bit of legal trouble. I've been busted smoking weed. I get busted at school playing with a toy gun, one of my friend's toy guns during Halloween. And so that was after, you know, school shootings and all
yep.
that.
They just started.
Mess with it. Yep. So they were real quick to bust me on that. And I tried mushrooms. And then that summer, transitioning into junior year, I tried cocaine for the first time. And that's when things really started to go downhill. Went back to school and was doing okay, but partying a lot more and lots more drugs are around. And then I'm looking for cocaine one day, and the guy comes back and he says, "I can't get cocaine, but I can get crystal for you, crystal meth." And I'd never tried it before. A lot of my friends had tried it. And I told myself and told them I was never going to try it. But I was like, I got this curiosity. And
just one time.
Just one time. Yep. And I try it, and the rest is history, man. My life just starts going downhill. You don't really realize it's happening when it's happening. But, mm-hmm. you know, within 9 months, I was in rehab, dropped out of school, and my life was just in a whirlwind. And I had injected, too. I started injecting. So I went to an outpatient treatment, and then they said they were going to send me to rehab because I couldn't quit. And when I learned I was going to rehab, I said, "Well, I'm just going to start shooting up because, you know, maybe rehab will fix me and I won't have to worry about it.
Just go ahead and just get this over with."
Yeah. Yep.
Dang.
So I'm shooting up at 17 years old, dropped out of school, get out of rehab, and I make it about about 5 hours before I'm smoking weed. And then make it about 2 weeks before I'm shooting up again. And it just keeps getting worse. And, you know, you get these little interventions in life and these opportunities to get better. Rehab mm-hmm. was one of them. And if you choose not to take advantage of that, it just gets worse. And it's almost, it's just, that's the way of, I don't know, the way God does it. He says,
it's almost like a rest stop, like a rest stop that you have a chance to rest, but you get back on the road.
Yeah, exactly. And it just gets worse. It's a progressive disease. So it's a progressive brain disease. So yeah, my friend started dying, suicides. My best friend hung himself. And then 10 days later, a girl I'd grown up with dies in a drinking and driving accident. 2 months later, a kid I'd known since kindergarten shoots himself. I had suicide attempts. I mean, just so much worse than what it was before. So that's all traumatic, and I don't mm-hmm. handle that very well. I go into a really bad psychosis. There's a point where I stayed awake for about 2 weeks or so and wasn't eating or drinking very much water or anything, drinking alcohol, if anything. But something switched in my brain. And that's when I went into psychosis, and that was a whole nother set of problems right there. So I'm in psychosis, and I have to deal with that, and I have to deal with the addiction. And so that's when, you know, my suicide attempts happened, and, you know, I tried cutting my throat with a razor blade, had a gun in my mouth. I start kind of getting it together after a while, because mm-hmm. I get my first felony, and after my first felony, I was like, all right, I need to slow down a little bit. I didn't get clean, but I slowed down. I tried to get a job, and I was just trying to function. And
by that time, you were in your 20s?
Let's see. I was 19 going on 20.
Okay.
Yep. So then I get a DUI because I'm drinking more because I'm not using drugs.
Yep.
And I figure, well, I'll just
replace it.
Yeah. Just be the best alcoholic I can be. So I do that, and that, you know, doesn't help very much, obviously. But I pick up this job painting houses. And so that keeps me busy enough during the summer that I'm starting to make some improvements. My mental health is improving. Things are kind of coming together.
Mm-hmm.
Not great. Still drinking, but not great. But then winter hits, and you don't paint houses in the winter in Colorado. Yeah,
so you have time on your hands.
I got too much time on my hands, and that's when I pick up another felony. And I get a little more jail time, and then you know, I'm kind of dealing with that through the whole winter. And by the time summer hits, I'm back painting houses. I'm staying out of trouble. Towards the end of summer, let's see, I was 20 years old, and I try heroin for the first time. And heroin didn't aggravate my psychosis like the meth did. So I
it was more tolerable.
Yes. Yes.
Wow.
Because it almost medicated the psychosis, if anything, because it kind of brought me down a little bit.
Okay.
You know? But I'm able to just, you know, I try it once, then I'm kind of staying away from it because I still got to go to work. I still got to do this. But then winter comes again, and I don't have any work. I don't have anything to do. So I start doing heroin a lot, and I'm on probation at this point. I have a lot to lose, and that's when I get my second DUI.
So and two felonies, two DUIs.
Two felonies, two DUIs. During this time frame is when I have another friend that hangs himself. And then a month later, I have another friend that dies in it was a suicide, it looked like. But it was a drinking and driving thing. Drinking, driving, and suicide. So I'm not holding it together real well. And I start missing probation appointments. And then I pick up my second DUI. And something happened when I picked up that second DUI. They were talking about throwing me in prison, and that, you know, that scared me. And when I went back to jail on sentencing for that, I got out and I just started making better decisions. I was still drinking,
mm-hmm.
but the hard drugs had stopped. So hard drugs were done. I'm working about 15 hours a day. I'm doing 4 or 5 hours for free in the morning doing community service mm-hmm. for my probation.
Yep.
And then I go to Domino's, work a couple hours there, and then I go work at the restaurant at night.
So you're busy as hell.
Yeah, and it was great. It was great. It was the best
thing. Keep you out of trouble.
Yeah. Yeah, I needed it. Because when I was a tweaker, I mean, I was going, you know, 48 hours.
What do I do? What do I do?
Yeah, 48 hours at a time before I crash. So, you know, working 15 hours a day sober was great. So I functioned like that for a couple years. get with my ex and have my son right here. And that was the best thing that ever could have happened to me. Because when I broke up with my ex, then, you know, I had potential to drink a lot. But because I had him, I was accountable to him.
Something to live for.
Yeah. Yep. So still staying clean. Still drinking, though. And when I don't have him, I'm drinking more. And, you know, I functioned like that for about 6 or 7 years. And I end up leaving my cooking job, and I work in a sheet metal shop. Not really happy there. But I find the gym. And the gym added a whole nother component to my life that I didn't know existed. So I'm going to the gym, and I decide I want to go to personal training school because I'm not happy in the sheet metal shop. So still drinking, though. And so I get laid off from the sheet metal shop because I think it's pretty obvious that I'm not really engaged, not really enjoying it. I'm not really working as hard as I could be. My attendance wasn't great. And they find out I'm going to personal training school. I don't know if that played a part, but I get laid off, and I start, the drinking picks up a little more. Still going to school, but drinking picks up. And so I'm not using any drugs, but I'm hanging around a crowd that's pretty sketchy and dangerous. You know, gang members, you know, biker gang, Sons of Silence. I mean, really everybody, Serenios, whatever. So still in pretty risky behavior, you know. And then I pick up what would have been my third DUI. And that one got me because I'd had my son. And I knew that if I had to go to jail, I would have a very hard time forgiving myself if I had to leave him, you know. but it gets dropped because the cop was out of his jurisdiction. So I decided.
That was a sign.
Yes. And that was, so like I was talking about before, you get those opportunities and those interventions in your life that God puts there. He says, hey, you can take advantage of this. This is an opportunity to quit. And I'd blown all those off before. Yep. But that case getting dropped, I was like, I'm not going to blow this off anymore. And so I make the decision to just be a different man. And that's when the beginning of the rest of my life started. So I got involved. I got my personal training certificate, finished school. Wasn't really sure what I wanted to do. Couldn't get hired at Gold's Gym or 24-Hour Fitness because they said I wasn't enough of a salesman. I was like, well, what am I going to do? And so I decided to work for myself. And I get involved in this business conference, and they talk about publishing books. And I'm like, well, I've got a story to tell, so let's put out a book. And
let's talk about the book.
Yeah. So my first book.
The first book, yep.
Yeah, first book came out, geez, it was like 4 years ago.
Wow. Before COVID.
Right before COVID, man. Yeah. And that was great, man. That's just, it feels pretty cool to write a book.
It was almost like another kid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. And it just, it sparked ideas for other books too. And so I'm working on the second book now. Well, I finished it. It's coming back from the editor here soon, and then I'll have to figure out how I want to market it and all that. But that's kind of where I'm at now. I got a program working with at-risk youth kids.
Let's talk about the program. Yes, yeah. Yes.
So, let's see. This started about 5 years ago, and started out where I was just networking. Like I said, I couldn't find a job at 24-Hour Fitness or Gold's Gym. So I just started networking, and I was like, well, I want to share my fitness journey with others who need it and share it with kids to try to give them another resource. And so I'm trying to figure out how to make a program out of this, how I can make a living out of this. I'm networking, going, you know, doing some volunteer work, anywhere I can get it, going to all these, you know, community meetings.
Trying to get your foot in the door.
Yes, exactly. So I finally get an opportunity. My friend Heidi comes up to me one day, and she says, hey, I got these kids coming through teen court, and, you know, they have some pretty petty charges like possession of marijuana, but they're at really high risk. They have a lot of trauma, and they mentioned that they want to go to the gym and that they just need a positive male role model in their life. I'm like, sign me up. And so that's kind of where it all started. It started with two kids. I still remember them, just taking them to the gym and working out with them and trying to keep them off of smoking weed. At least till they got out of teen court, but, more kids started getting referred to me, and, I was working out with them. And then I made a partnership with a licensed professional counselor, He's like, well, let's add the therapeutic side to it. And so we started doing that. And since then, he stepped back and moved back to Arizona. But my mom has stepped in as my business partner. And she kind of kept our program going when we needed someone licensed to oversee everything. And so we're an activity-based program. And we offer therapy and mentorship. And we're running a summer camp program now. And we're just trying to get more resources to the kids to keep them out of trouble. And we want to share some of our experiences that we went through, and hopefully they can take a page out of our playbook to keep themselves out of trouble.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, this podcast concerns itself with the care, not care thing. How can that be applied to when you mentor kids, where they think that something is important, but it's not really important, or maybe their priorities are misplaced?
Mm. That's a tough one, because kids have totally different priorities than adults.
Yeah.
And when you're at that age, it's natural and it's important that you bond with people, because relationships are important to being a healthy human. The trouble is when you bond with unhealthy people, then unhealthy things happen.
Correct.
So that's kind of what we see on a daily basis. And then, of course, their brain isn't fully developed, so that prefrontal cortex is not functioning. And so they don't get that, you know, they need to prioritize going to school and doing their homework over hanging out with their friends and smoking pot.
They don't see the end result.
Right. And they don't think 5 years down the road how things are going to play out. So that's we like to challenge their thinking with that. And we use a lot of motivational interviewing. I don't know if you're familiar with that at all.
What is that?
It's basically asking them a lot of open-ended questions. And then when they answer, you reflect their answers back to them. And so they, it's very, what do I want to say? It's self-efficient, or it is very dependent on their willingness to want to engage.
Gotcha.
Which is challenging sometimes if they don't want to engage, but it's basically, you know, the whole theory behind it is whatever answer they're looking for to correct their lives is already within them. We have to ask the right questions for them to
find out. In order to draw it out.
Yeah. And so we'll ask a lot of open-ended questions, get them talking. And then when we find thinking errors or contradictions in their thinking, we reflect it back to them without being offensive or anything. But, you know, to challenge them. Be like, well, I hear you say, you know, you want a better life. You want your parents to get off your back. You want to stay out of jail, but here's what you're doing. Here's your behaviors. And here's what you're telling me about your perspective on those behaviors. And so that kind of gets them thinking rationally a little bit.
You know what really kind of amazes me that, when kids get into trouble, adults who have never experienced that, they always think it's like a kid, you know, who only has like a mom or maybe a dad at home. But like you said, you came from a great home and you went down the rabbit hole anyway. And so how does that speak to other people out there with a great home? You know, talk to people who have all the chances in the world and still it goes down the rabbit hole.
Yeah. Yeah, no one's exempt from it, especially when it comes to drug addiction and things like that. And there's a lot of things that play into behavioral issues and addiction. Childhood trauma, you know, absent parent, parent who's incarcerated, parent who's addicted, whatever. Those definitely, I mean, that definitely plays a part. But that's not the only thing that causes drug addiction. It's genetic. So if you have a parent who's an alcoholic, even a grandparent, uncle, something, if it's in the family, it could, you know, be passed down somehow. Genetics, then we got the environment too. And so we're not just talking about the environment at home, but who's your kid hanging out with on a daily basis? You know, if those kids are involved with things and your kid is in that environment, then that's going to be a risk factor for him too. Even if he comes from a great home and all this,
doesn't matter.
And, there's a lot of kids who I can remember. My mom set me up with this lawyer when I had I think it was my second felony. And, you know, he was helping me out, but he was also trying to help me personally. He was doing his best, the best he knew how, but, he sat me down one day and he said, you know, Nate, you really need to, there's no reason for you to be engaging in these behaviors. And you know, I would understand if you had a dad who wasn't there or something, but you shouldn't be doing this. And, it just pissed me off back then because I wasn't ready to hear that, but, it was just not that it was a bad
thing. This guy's trying to help you and you're pissed off at him.
And I'm pissed off. Yeah. So, you know, that reminded me of, or it made me think, this guy doesn't really know everything I've been through either, mm-hmm. though. So even though everything's okay on the outside, he has no clue what happened to me in my childhood or, you never know, man. There's stuff that happens in people's lives and, you never know what it is, or even if it's something that seems small, you don't know what it means to them or how it struck their emotions.
So does something like that guide you in helping others? You know, you just don't take it for granted and say, hey, you need to stop doing that. But you know, there's always something behind the scenes happening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I was talking with one of our therapists and she said, the right thing said at the wrong time is not helpful, you know, or it could potentially even be damaging. So that he was totally right.
Yeah.
You know, I agree now with what he had to say, but I just wasn't ready for it because there was still issues that I had that weren't dealt with.
And how do you not do that coming from your perspective?
Listen, ask questions, build rapport. Okay. Once you have someone's trust, then that's when you can maybe throw some advice out there. And even advice only works so much. And you have to be very tactful with how you give advice. And this is something I try to use in my mentoring. So like I said, getting rapport is huge. If you don't have the trust of someone you're working with, they're not going to hear a word you say. So you got to have trust with them. You have to qualify yourself as a person who knows what they're talking about in their eyes. And so that's done by just a lot of dialogue.
And doesn't it help that you've been through it? You've been through the storm. Mm-hmm. I talk to people, I'm divorced, and I really think sometimes, can a therapist be a good divorce therapist if they've never been divorced? Mm. You know, and I know they can.
Sure.
But there's always that little thing in the back of my mind, you know, can a drug and alcohol counselor be a good drug and alcohol counselor if they've never been a druggie? Or, you know, so that's always that little guy on my shoulder.
Yeah. And that's there is something to be said for that. And what I actually talked about this last week with my mom and one of our therapists, you know, she's not an addict. Mm-hmm. She's had some hard times in her life, but we were talking about this. And if we look at addiction as a mental health disease, then what we can draw from that is, you know, if someone has diabetes or has any other type of disease, they go to a doctor. Now, does that doctor have diabetes himself or Correct. Have cancer? Not Yep. necessarily, but you know, this doctor can treat their symptoms and help them get through that. So that's what I try to tell addicts and people who are kind of resistant to getting therapy and getting help from someone who hasn't been through addiction is, mm-hmm. well, they don't necessarily have to. You know, you can still get help from that person.
And they've helped so many people. You know, they have a root system where they've helped so many people. So they've seen it. And so they know how it goes.
That's exactly it. And sometimes it's even better because they're more objective.
Yep.
Now there is something to be said for the effects of drug addiction, and it's very, unless you've been through it, you don't know what it is totally.
Mm-hmm.
But that goes with anything in life.
Yep.
You know, like you said, divorces or whatever, you don't really know till you go through it. And I also put the responsibility back to the addict and say, well, if all these people in the world who are normies is what we call them, people who haven't been through addiction.
Okay.
And, you know, you feel like you can't relate to people. They just don't understand. Whose job is it going to be to teach them about that? It's going to be our job. It's our responsibility. So it's
so
our
they're going to cure people and they're going to learn at the same time.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it's almost like a domino effect. So they're helping people, but then they're learning from that person how to cure them, and then they can help cure the next person.
Absolutely. Yep. That's the way I see it.
Dang.
And I think it's our responsibility to tell people about it. So.
Well, man, that was interesting. Dang. Who needs paper? Any more things?
You know, I don't think so, man.
Dang, we hit it all.
Yeah.
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 Okay. Well, we want to thank Nate for coming by, man. That was, we definitely got to get Julie back.
Yeah.
You know, we talked about it. You know, we got to get Julie back and maybe her husband. He's a therapist too, right?
He's a psychologist. So he's a doctor. He's got it all, man.
Dang, you got all those people in your life.
Uh-huh.
All right, everybody. I want to thank you for listening to Attentive While Oblivious podcast episode 33. All right. Have a nice night. Bye-bye.
Thanks.